It's a bit warmer in New York today than it's been recently. Nonetheless, it seems as though so far this year we have had some of the coldest weather in recent memory. So today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the cold, where it comes from and how it affects us. And I'm joined by Dr. John Castellani, research physiologist with the U.S. Army Research Institute for Environmental Medicine in Natick, Massachusetts, and by David Phillips, Dr. David Phillips, who is one of Canada's best-known climatologists. He's written three books about weather and is also the creator of Canada's Weather Trivia Calendar, and I'm very pleased to welcome the two of you to our show today.
Well, thank you very much, Leonard. Nice to be with you and John.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on the show today.
David, let's begin with you. First, where does cold weather originate? Can we blame it all on Canada?
Well, we blame it on the Siberians, Leonard. So if you blame it on us, we actually think that we send you in the summertime. We make up for all the cold air that we send you in the wintertime with giving you those heat wave ending, air pollution ridding Canadian air, which is usually fresh and pristine and clear. So we think if there was free trade in weather, we'd probably win out on that. But, you know, Leonard, there are source regions for both warm air and cold air on this planet. In the southern hemisphere, it's pretty well all there. The cold air is over Antarctica. In the northern hemisphere, where we live, my gosh, there are several places which we'd call cold poles. One certainly exists out in over Alaska, the Yukon, that sort of northwestern part of North America. Of course, I also think of Greenland, a very cold piece of territory. And, of course, in Siberia, in the eastern Russia, over that landmass, a really cold area. And so what happens in these areas, and notice I didn't say the North Pole. The North Pole is cold, but my gosh, some of these areas to the south of the North Pole are actually colder. And what happens at this time of the year, in the wintertime, the axis of the Earth actually its axis is such that it's tilted away from the sun. So the sun is, even though the sun is actually closer to the Earth, the planet Earth, at this time, because the northern hemisphere is tilted away from the sun, we're not getting the direct rays from the sun. And so places in northern latitudes are actually 24 hours of darkness. The nights are very long. And any of the heat that's at the surface just radiates up to space. There's no cloud there to trap it in and warm the surface up. It just lost right to space. And of course, the ground is snow covered, and snow is a great insulator. And any of that heat in any of the lakes or water or ground, well, it just can't get up to the surface. And so what happens under clear skies and light winds and that, my gosh, that 24 hours of darkness, and with the sun is actually, if there is any radiation at those northern latitudes, it's not direct. It's passing through more atmosphere, and so there's less intensity to it. And that just cools it off, and the air gets colder and colder, and week after week, and then month, it builds up, and then it moves out. It just moves southward and chills us. So we can blame it on those cold poles. That's where the cold air originates.
Well, although I've heard that Canadians are very proud of being in the second coldest country on Earth.
Well, you know, Leonard, you're right. We used to be the coldest, and it wasn't El Nino, La Nina, or global warming. It was actually politics that took that. And I thought, Leonard, that, my gosh, I discovered that. I knew that we were the coldest at one time. I had looked at the average temperature over all of Canada and compared it with Russia and Mongolia and Scandinavian countries in the United States, and I said, my gosh, we are the coldest. And then when the Soviet Union broke up and the Russian Federation was left with Siberia, the Urals, lost all those warm parts of their country, and Georgia and the Ukraine and the Balkan countries, they were left with the colds. And I said to our communications people here in our weather service, well, let's announce that during a real cold spot, make Canadians feel good about it. And when we announced that we were in second place, well, there was a disappointment among Canadians. They said, what do you mean we're only in second place? And somewhere between the Russia and Federation and Mongolia, we were well entrenched there in second place. And But anyway, so we're not the coldest, but we still brag about the fact that we are a cold country and we are the snowiest country in the world. And so we at least gain our winter reputation, and we wear it proudly.
This is Please Explain on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm talking with Dr. David Phillips, the Canadian climatologist, and with Dr. John Castellani, a research physiologist with the U.S. Army Research Institute for Environmental Medicine. And John, does cold air have particular physical properties that warm air doesn't?
No, not really. It's just that you know, the body responds differently, you know, based on the environment that it's in.
And isn't that what you study? How people respond to cold?
That's correct. Up here at our institute here in Massachusetts for the U.S. Army, we try to study human performance in these different environmental extremes. And so when it gets cold, you know, people will respond, you know, in two main ways to try to stay warm. In the heat, of course, we try to dissipate the amount of heat we have inside of us, so we sweat and try to evaporate heat off. But in the cold, we're trying to conserve the heat that we have inside us so that we don't get too cold. And so the first thing that happens with people when they go into a cold environment, or say they step outside from being inside in the office all day, is that a little bit of cold on their face or on some of their exposed skin will cause nerve endings in that area to send signals to the brain, and then that will send a signal back to that area to try to clamp it down, the amount of blood that goes out to that area.
Well, how much of that is in our minds? How much does how we think we feel affect how we respond to the cold?
Really not much at all. People certainly have are adverse to cold. They have conjure up all kinds of images about the cold. But in terms of how the body physiologically responds to when it gets placed into a cold environment, it responds the way it needs to, which is to try to conserve heat. And it takes a lot of effort to try to mentally. There are some studies that suggest that hypnosis, for example, may affect how you might shiver, but for the average person, they can't do that, and so the body will respond appropriately, trying to limit how much heat that we lose out into the environment.
Well, do we respond differently to different kinds of cold? People out west in Canada and the United States talk about a dry cold being much easier to tolerate. Is that true?
Certainly, yeah. When you, it's more of a feeling of how much it's really the rate of heat loss that really affects sometimes how we feel. It feels to us. So if you're in a cold, say dry environment, you might have a certain amount of heat being lost from the skin, which if you were in a wetter environment or it was more humid or you had sweat on your skin, you'd actually potentially lose a bit more heat from that area. Because you know, wet and wet, you know, environments pull heat a lot quicker, and so by doing that, we sense that flux and that change in the rate of heat loss, and certainly, yeah, we sense it a lot differently, and we also, depending on you know your conditions that you're in, if you're well clothed in a cold, dry environment, for example, you know your chances of hypothermia are pretty low. But if you were in a situation where it was above freezing, but it was raining out, for example, you could actually be at a much greater risk for getting hypothermia because of the great amount of heat that you would lose in that cold, wet environment.
So, David, why does it feel less cold to us when it's snowing? The air would be moister, wouldn't it? Which would suggest that we should feel colder when it snows.
Well, you know, it's cold air. One of the physical properties of cold air, it's drier. And there's often people will say, is it ever too cold to snow? Well, no, it's never too cold to snow. And even up in the very high Arctic, you would get, there'd be a lot of days with snow. Now, maybe just be a little dusting or a skiff of snow, not the call of Paul Bunyan kind of snowfalls that we see in lower latitudes. But the moisture content of cold air, very dry and clear often, and not necessarily a lot of wind associated with it, but so therefore you can't really get the heavy amount of snow. But if you take a look at where we often get our biggest dumps of snow, you will find that the temperature is much more elevated, closer to the 30 2-degree mark, you know, maybe minus 25, minus 26, and even a couple degrees warmer above freezing, you could still get those kind of big dumps of snow, because the air mass, it's certainly cold air has come from the north, and it's maybe dragged in some the storm system, some moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, and so it's lots of cargoes of moisture in the cold air, and boy, there is a potential there for dumping huge amounts of snow. So it
feels warmer because it is warmer.
Pardon?
So it feels warmer because it actually is warmer.
Right. The temperature is elevated, but you know, you wouldn't find in the high Arctic big dumps of snow. You wouldn't find even in parts of, say, Montana, areas on the Great Plains. You wouldn't get the huge amounts of snow that you would get in, say, New York and New England, and certainly here in Canada, in eastern Canada, we get far more snow than they do on the Canadian prairies, for example.
In Canada, don't you use Celsius instead of Fahrenheit?
We do now,
because you've been very kind and you've been giving us temperatures in Fahrenheit. But is Celsius a better way to measure cold?
Well, it's a scale. I think it's much, once you get used to it, I think it's it seems a little easier. But you know, Leonard, what I have found, Canadians, we have been, we were using Fahrenheit right up to about the 1970s. Then there was a national campaign to switch over to metric, and it was painful for seniors, but now children today don't even know what Fahrenheit is. We only report temperatures in Celsius. But what I find old timers will tell me, and I've noticed this too, that they will use Fahrenheit in the summer and Celsius in the winter, because 100 degrees Fahrenheit seems a lot warmer than 37 degrees C.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, a temperature of, minus 20 degrees C, equivalent to about, say, minus 2 degrees Fahrenheit, seems a lot colder. So we switch back and forth, but I would say that most Canadians now feel familiar and use the Celsius, as most countries around the world. I think the United States is one of the very few, if the only country that publicly uses Fahrenheit, although I'm sure John, in his research, only uses Celsius.
I'm sure that's true, John, isn't it?
That is correct. We only use Celsius, and that's what I have on my car when I drive, is I have it listed as Celsius. So.
Now, what about wind chill, John? I just read recently that some scientists are even challenging the concept.
Well, the wind chill is kind of an interesting idea. If people aren't familiar with where it came from, it was actually developed by an Army scientist who more or less was bored during a tour in the Antarctic back in the 1940s, and looked at the rate of water freezing based on the air temperature and how much the wind was blowing. And then based on those measurements that were made by Dr. Seipel, is that it got morphed into essentially an idea of, well, how cold does it feel rather than what it is. And so it morphed into that idea and was used in that regard for a long, long time in terms of trying to equate both the air and the wind together. Back in 2001, actually a joint effort between our U.S.'s National Weather Service and Environment Canada looked back at the wind chill to start to look at it, because there was a whole idea that they would say that the wind chill might be minus 20, but boy, it didn't actually feel like it was that cold. But there's a lot of other factors that played a role with that. For example, the sun is not, and solar radiation was not part of that equation. And certainly when you're out on a cold day with the sun out, it feels much warmer with the solar radiation than it does if you're, you know, on a shady day, for example. And so that's why the wind chill changed in terms, they started looking at it, and they started looking at the equations that compute the number that comes out when you combine air temperature and wind speed. I think one of the most important things that we garnered from that change back in 2001 is that actually one of my colleagues that at the time worked in Toronto, they started using the wind chill to look at the relative risk of frostbite as a marker, and so that you actually could tag what the wind chill number is to your risk of getting frostbite, in this case, risk of frostbite on the cheek, since most people are pretty well clothed and they might be standing on a bus stop, you know, slowly walking, trying to stay warm while waiting. And so they did some studies in the laboratory looking at different wind chill numbers And we're able to actually put the relative risk of frostbite against a certain number. And so that's been one of the biggest things that's come out of the use of the wind chill that doesn't get played up as much.
We're going to go to a break in a moment. Our number here, by the way, is 212-433-9692. We invite our audience to join this conversation, 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You wanted to add to that, David.
Well, just to say that I think that certainly I find that most meteorologists, forecasters, don't like the wind chill because what they find is that the public embellishes it. We start off the morning saying, well, it's, you know, let's say it's 15 degrees Fahrenheit outside, but the wind chill is minus 2. And by the end of the afternoon or the day, people are going around just saying, well, it's minus 2 outside. And certainly it affects humans, living creatures, but doesn't affect mailboxes and fences or car radiators. But just the other point I quickly like to mention, Leonard, is that, and John mentioned it, is the fact of the sun. The sun is often forgotten when we talk about the cold, and because in Canada, the United States, all over the world, we measure temperature in the shade. So when you go out there in Minneapolis and the temperature is a minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit, in the sun, you might be getting another 7, 8, 9 degrees of warmth. So a tip for your listeners is always look for the sunny side of the street, because even though the temperature is reported as lower, you will actually feel warmer with that sun, as long as the wind is not blowing, that sun streaming down on you.
John, do women respond physiologically differently to cold than men?
More or less, no difference. I mean, they constrict their skin when it's to try to limit heat loss, and they shiver when their body core gets lower. The one thing that we see a lot different with women than with men, of course, is that there are modifiers to how we respond to the cold, and one of those things is, for example, body composition. You know, how much muscle mass do you have, and how much body fat do you have? And so based on that. You know, if you take a general person, you know, a general guy and a general woman, you know, the man will have a little more lean body mass, more muscle, and a little less fat. And so fat's a good insulator. So if you have more fat on you, you will tend not to lose as much heat, and you should be able to, you know, retain your heat a little bit better. So as a generality, you know, if you have a little more body fat on you, which, again, the average woman would, they would tend to, in the same environment, more or less have a slightly better response in terms of if you were in an environment that would promote your body temperature to fall, they would not fall to the same degree.
John,
again, we're not talking
about
huge numbers, but there's a small difference.
Would age be a factor, too?
Age is a factor.
Yeah.
You know, as people age, actually, their ability to shiver goes down. And also their ability to constrict their skin and limit heat loss goes down also. So they'll actually, you know, lose more heat and are at risk for walking around with lower body temperatures. As you get older, too, actually, the behaviorally or how we sense the cold, for example, also goes down. So some people may feel fine, but, you know, so they're actually lowering, you know, sometimes they feel, you know, it's, They don't sense it as much, and so they may change their thermostats a little bit differently based on that. So, yes, as you age, your ability to tolerate the cold, it becomes less.
We're going to take a little break. Our guests on Please Explain Today are Dr. John Castellani, research physiologist with the U.S. Army Research Institute for Environmental Medicine, and Dr. David Phillips, one of, Canada's most well-known climatologist, author of 3 books about weather, and creator of Canada's Weather Trivia Calendar. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Stay with us. And we're back with our guests on Please Explain, Dr. David Phillips and Dr. John Castellani, talking about cold. And our number here is 212-433-9692. We'll be taking the calls in just a second. But, David, it does seem as though this winter we've had more cold weather and snow. And I saw a letter to the editor the other day that suggested that global warming is a myth. Should we feel a little relieved because of the cold weather this year?
I don't think so, Leonard. I mean, we often hear that every time people, first of all, in a cold bout, they'll say, "Bring on global warming. Where is it? Is it just a lot of hot air?" And but no, this is really, I often say, this is just weather. And you look out the window, you can see weather, but you can't see climate change. 2008, for example, was a colder year than 2007, and people thought, "Oh my gosh, global warming is over. We're going back to the ice age." And but it's still 2008, looking at over the past 150 years, was the 10th warmest. So the evidence is still very solid and clear that the world is warming up faster and greater now. And one little bout of a cold winter or a couple of cold or snowy winters, whether it be in Europe or North America, does not necessarily mean that the trend in the future will be for warmer conditions. I often say to Canadians, they often hope, Leonard, that they become the Miami of the North in global warming. They can hardly wait for that. And I'll say, well, you know, we'll still be the land of ice and snow. It just means maybe our winters will be a little shorter. The cold won't be as intense. But there are a lot of surprises in nature, and maybe this is just a surprise, a reminder that, hey, there are a lot of things that bring you the weather, and it, from El Nino to La Nina to polar lows, everything like that, and this is not just this does not really change the situation with regards to climate change.
The real indicators are what's happening in Antarctica and with the ice sheet in Greenland, for example.
Well, exactly, everywhere. I mean, the other one thing that I think is so really convincing about the climate change is that there's no place that's been left out in the cold, so to speak, whether it be in Antarctica, Greenland, or the Arctic ice cap, or be from vegetation, or every corner of this planet is seeing change like we haven't in many years. And I think that is really one of the hallmarks of the proof that the world is changing dramatically from a temperature point of view, and just one bout of cold weather does not necessarily change that trend.
Let's take some calls. Our first caller is Mike from Bedford, New Jersey. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. What's your question?
I had a question about how elevation affects the way we feel cold. Let's say, you know, I'm a skier. I'll ski at 10,000 feet, 20 degrees, 70% relative humidity. Is that going to feel different than, you know, skiing at 1,000 feet under the same conditions?
John?
Well, certainly as you go up in altitude, your temperature goes down, and in terms of the air temperature, it's funny, I'm actually trying to get that number. It's about a 3-degree difference, I guess, for every Fahrenheit, for about every 1,000 feet that you go up. So it starts to go down. In terms of just being, you know, at altitude, you know, actually, if you have a little lower blood oxygen content, it actually does affect your ability to deal with the cold. You actually do not constrict as well, and you also do not shiver as well. Again, for the average skier who's up there and then coming down the mountain and like that, you know, for a short period of time, it really has minimal impact. But there are effects from going high, both from the temperature and from the way your body reacts.
How does alcohol, why does alcohol make you feel warmer?
Well, alcohol, you know, in many ways it moves blood flow to the periphery. And so we don't really sense cold, for example, in our core. We always sense temperature out in our periphery towards our skin. And so when we move warmer blood out towards our skin, it does bring some of those sensations of warmth. But interestingly enough, alcohol itself, you know, it's not so much that we're actually losing more heat to the environment more so that people get in trouble with alcohol. Well, people get in trouble in the cold with alcohol because they get intoxicated and do honestly stupid things. But it's actually, if you reach a point where you drink too much, it actually lowers the amount of glucose or sugar in your blood, and that affects how well you can react to the cold physiologically. So you're not really dumping more heat, but you're changing the way your body adjusts to the heat.
Susan from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, medically speaking, why is it important not to get cold? I assume that when, you know, people say, oh, you know, keep the baby warm or he'll get a cold, it's not really that, because it's germs that give you a cold, not being cold. So medically speaking, why is it important not to be cold, and what does being cold have to do with getting a germ, you know, virus or something?
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, we've studied here at our institute a little bit, looking at, you know, for example, immune function in the cold, and in fact, it is true. You're correct. You know, germs cause colds, not cold. But cold weather doesn't really make you more susceptible, at least from some of our information that we've collected. Some people suggest that, you know, you actually may break down some of the defenses in your nose if it's cold enough and allow those germs actually to make it a little easier to get in there. So when you're congregating more, you know, with people like we do in the winter, which is why we you know, pass colds on a lot easier, we there may be, but it's very limited data to say that it's because the nose, you know, is allowing that germ in a little easier. In terms of medically speaking about, you know, cold, what's bad? Well, a couple of things are bad if it's cold enough. One is, you know, the two major injuries that we have to be worried about. One is frostbite, so it's actually, you know, death of tissue, you know, usually on the periphery, like your fingers, your toes, you know, nose and earlobes. And then the other problem that we typically run into is hypothermia, people having actually a lower body temperature. Which, if it gets low enough, of course, can kill you. So those are the two major medical problems that can occur, you know, if it's too cold.
Let's go to Nina from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I was wondering if there have been any studies to determine whether there is a genetic or ethnic difference in how people are equipped to deal with cold or hot. I'm half Greek and half Indian, two very hot climates, and everybody always assumes I would love hot weather, but I actually despise it. And I wonder if I'm an anomaly or if there is actually some truth to what people, you know, tend to assume.
Well, sir, we actually have very little information on looking at some of those factors like that. We really haven't studied that to any great degree.
Isn't this really an environmental thing? I would guess that an Inuit child growing up in Miami would feel very cold going up to the Yukon.
They certainly would feel cold, and there are adaptations that take place that will make you feel, you will sense it a bit differently. We call it habituation. But over time, you know, that will go away. The bigger problem that we tend to see is not so much, we're getting more from a genetic, but more the way people are built. You know, long, tall, skinny people, say with very long, skinny fingers, are a lot more at risk, for example, of frostbite, just because of the way they're built. You know, they're built to get rid of heat. Well, when you're in a cold environment, if you're built to dump heat, that's a bad thing. Whereas, you know, genetically, at least over time, evolutionary-wise, take a look at, like, Eskimos, for example. They are a little smaller in stature, will have smaller hands. So they've evolved to a point where, you know, they're built to try to limit the amount of heat that they lose compared to, say, someone who lives near the equator.
Scandinavians tend to have less facial hair than people who live along the Mediterranean. Is facial hair bad? I would have thought it would have warmed up the face.
I honestly don't know the answer to that, and I actually didn't know that about Scandinavians. So,
Well, there are plenty of Scandinavians with big beards, but I think that is it's kind of true. Joseph from Forest Hills, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. You were talking earlier about the way men and women feel, the difference between the way men and women feel temperature. My wife, when she's pregnant, she says that she feels a lot warmer than otherwise, and I was wondering if, A, that's something that's empirically established, and B, if that affects one's risk for hypothermia and frostbite.
That's not been studied to my knowledge. In fact, when we wrote a recent position paper for the American College of Sports Medicine, that's one of those things we looked for was, you know, risk in certain groups, and actually looking at pregnancy was something we didn't run across at all from any groups studying this anywhere. So I really can't answer that, and we have no evidence to say that, you know, she would change physiologically, you know, to the cold, you know, when she goes into the cold, being pregnant or not. I can't answer that.
David, Amy in Manhattan left a comment on our show page. She wants to know why people with asthma, but maybe it's all people, have trouble breathing in extreme cold.
Ooh, well, you know, I think that the air is drier, and certainly that may create a problem. We know that certainly people who live in dry climates, cold climates, for example, don't have have skin problems. They age faster. They don't have the kind of moist skin that you would have in more of a humid climate. For example, in Calgary, in Western Canada, we often say that people have you know, their lips crack. They look older than Easterners, and so one of the disadvantages, I suppose, of living in a dry climate. So I would think that somebody with breathing problems would like some more additional moisture in the air, and I think that a dry climate would be, certainly in the wintertime, cold and dry air may be certainly more difficult with people with respiratory problems.
A listener wonders whether we should put coats on dogs in the cold.
Well, certainly, I think one of the whenever we get into a cold wave, often the Humane Society is quickly to come out with "Don't forget your pets." If you feel the cold, so does your pet, and I certainly think that people should be mindful of the environmental conditions, cold weather, in terms of walking their dogs or cats or letting them out to do their thing in cold weather. So I've seen people will often put little pads or booties on their feet. I know I used to have a dog. I called him Winston the Weather Dog, and boy, he could tell the weather like better than I could. And he knew exactly when it got down to minus 7 degrees C. That would probably be about say 20 degrees F. He just knew it wasn't good for him, and he wouldn't go outside. So, but I think it's important. It depends on the different types of breeds of dogs, but people should always take care of their pets under cold weather conditions.
John, in 10 seconds, should we wear hats, as our mother told us, because so much of the body heat goes through our heads? Should we layer?
We should layer. We should wear a hat, but we don't lose as much heat as we, you know, people popularly believe it was like 50, 60, 70%.
We have to leave it there. I'm sorry, Dr. John Castellani, Dr. David Phillips. It's been a real pleasure having you as my guests on today's Please Explain.
Thank you very much, Leonard. Bye, John.
You're welcome. Thank you.